Blog Talk Radio.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, it is primetime baseball season in New York. Yeah, you can't get a ticket for tonight's game under $300 to Citi Field. Why? Well, because Chase Utley is there, of course. I mean, why else would they be $300 to see the Dark Knight take out the Joker, which is what I have now referred to Chase Utley. Welcome to the show, everybody. A very, very angry Sean Palmer, well, at least in case of losing my shortstop or our shortstop, and Seth Kamens, who is a very happy man today after, I don't know, it's probably your best weekend, at least sports-wise, in a very long period of time. You got a win last night, and you lost the guy you wanted to lose for 3 years.
Yeah, there's no great pat on the back for wanting Randy Edsall out of Maryland. Welcome to the show, everybody. Someday we're going to get our opening music. I kind of miss it, but, you know, for another time, I guess. Yeah, I mean, we can get to Randy Edsall and Steve Sarkisian and my weekend first. But I think we got to start. We have to start with Major League Baseball, and you have to start with. Really? Is this 1989?
I was just trying.
I just like, I can see that. I just like, I want a whiskey drink. I want a gin drink. I want a vodka drink. Something along those lines. There's a lot of drinking. And we drink songs to remind us of the good times and drink songs to remind us of the bad times. And right now, Ruben Tejada is probably having a few of those. As all of you know who are listening to this show, because anyone who's a sports fan has seen umpteen reviews, replays of Chase Utley doing his best. I don't know what exactly that was. Whether it was it looked like a cut block from an offensive lineman taking out Tejada, breaking his leg, and then somehow. Being called safe because he never got tagged because Utley broke his leg. I think my IQ dropped just saying those words.
Okay, so I've listened to Joe Torre. I've listened to the explanations of this. I've come to understand where the umpire and where Joe Torre have come around in their belief that they made the right call. I understand what they're saying. I disagree with it, but I understand it. So let's go through what they believe happened. So what they believe happened was that Chase Utley was in the baseline, that Ruben Tejada, while he did not touch the bag, does not constitute a neighborhood play, because of his little pirouette. And because of that, when they called him out, Chase Utley didn't have to touch the bag because he had already been called out, and thus he left the field. The challenge was made because Tejada never touched the bag. I get all that. I get Joe Torre's explanation. I get the umpire's explanation. I get it. Now, for those that do not know what a neighborhood play is, and I've been asked this now 5 times in the last 2 days, a neighborhood play, the quote neighborhood play, was meant to protect the second baseman and the shortstop from injury. Yeah. So what does the neighborhood play mean? It means that when a second baseman or a shortstop is trying to turn a double play, they do not necessarily have to touch the bag in order to make the turn of a double play because they are trying to avoid the runner making a hard stop into second base to prevent leg injuries. Now, let's let that sink in for a moment. So, in this case, Tejada didn't touch the bag. He was in the neighborhood of second base. He got injured. To me, that's a neighborhood play. if this is a neighborhood play, none of this matters. Secondly,
I think.
Okay, go ahead. Please. I'm sorry. I'm in a
no,
rant.
No. Please. I would rather you get it out. Speak to the masses, please.
The second thing is, was this interference? Interference is characterized if a player is going after a second baseman or a shortstop or any other position out of the baseline for the purpose of not hitting the base, but to interfere with the play, or basically to break his leg. All right. So Joe Torre and Major League Baseball said it was not a neighborhood play because it was a pirouette, which was actually very well done, pirouette. It was not interference. For some ungodly reason, it was not interference, which I don't exactly know how it wasn't. And because of that, not only did Chase Utley not have to touch second base, but because Tejada didn't touch second base, Chase Utley was allowed back in.
And once again, let's remember, why didn't Tejada touch second base?
Because the guy is fouling him.
Because the guy broke his leg.
Well, no,
I am not a mess.
The leg actually happened after he missed the base. Okay, let's be fair. Okay, so he actually got his leg down and just missed the base. He was right next to the base.
Yeah.
So, to be fair, Utley didn't hit him before he went to touch the base. But
no, he did not.
Utley
didn't even start his slide until he was well past the base,
right.
Number one. Number two, ironically, this is not the first time we've had an Utley Tejada incident. If you look back to 2010, when he was with the beloved Phillies, there was another issue between Utley and Tejada. I actually find it hard to imagine Tejada's been with the Mets for that long. But, you know, what I find so ironic is the player who is most well-known for doing the neighborhood play, who never, ever touched second base. Do you know who that is?
Jimmy Rollins?
No, Willie Randolph.
Oh, well.
And you know who Willie Randolph's first baseman was?
Don Mattingly.
Yeah, ironic that the coach of the – that was where the argument went, that the coach of the Dodgers ends up being the beneficiary of this. And the neighborhood play is something that's been given, it's gone on for 30 years. It's a given in the league. And I find it extremely silly and disappointing that, and again, I'm not a Mets fan. You know, I root for them because they're New York, but I have no real interest here, vested interest. And so
vested interest, Seth. You don't want me to kill somebody.
Well, anyway, come see. But, no worries. But I guess I see this, and I wonder on something else, and it's slightly sarcastic and slightly rhetorical. If Troy Tulowitzki or Derek Jeter was the recipient of that slide, what are the chances Chase Utley would be playing tonight? I guess forgetting the appeal, what are the chances we wouldn't be seeing a rule be instituted the next day or the next week?
Well,
there is
Seth,
not
you're
doubt
not the first person
mind.
To ask that, because Justin Upton, all-star for the Braves and now plays for the Diamondbacks, then went to the Braves and now is on the Padres, said that exact same thing on Twitter, where he said if Tulo had broken his leg, you would have the Tulo rule within 24 hours. And here's my problem with this, okay? If you want to make the mistake, mistakes are made. They are. They happen in everyday life. They happen in sports. Look, I'm good. Okay, he broke his leg. I'm not happy about it. But to me, that it was either interference or it was the neighborhood play. Okay. And to me, that's a mistake that was made. So the NFL, who also has replay, this is why the NFL is a better league. the NFL goes every single week, has replays. Replays are meant to fix the game, and sometimes they do. And as we saw in the Detroit game last week, sometimes they're just flat out wrong. But what does the NFL do every Tuesday, Seth?
They review every play, and they have the right to, I don't know where you're going with it, they have the right to criticize umps publicly, although it's not always done.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you knew where I was going. They admit mistakes.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I was wrong. Yeah.
It's not going to take back the loss that the Giants have or that the Lions have or that the Jets have or the Pats have. It's not going to rectify the loss. It's not going to change the game that was played. But they are, and I don't want to say man enough, they are sturdy enough in their beliefs that they say, you know what, we made mistakes. And these are the mistakes that we made. My problem with Major League Baseball is that they have stood by this decision, that they have not said that it was a mistake, that they go and they double down on the error, and then they go and suspend Chase Utley. Well, if I'm Chase Utley, I think this is a preposterous suspension. You've already told me what I did was okay, both on the field and in the press conference afterwards, Joe Torre said it wasn't interference. Well, if it's not interference and it's not I tried to take out the guy because I wasn't ejected, in fact, I came back on the field and played second base, my question to Joe Torre, if I'm Chase Utley, is what exactly did I do wrong?
Or you can look at it from the other direction. You can say, well, they're suspending him simply because he may not get out of New York alive.
Well, he's not in the lineup today, but he is eligible because they appealed the suspension. And you can't have a suspension in 12 hours. You can't have an appeal in 12 hours. So
he will be there for the series, but it will be a very, 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 very interesting to see how this plays out over the next 2 days. And
well, I saw something by one of my favorite players, Tommy John. Tommy John said at one point he faced this guy, I don't remember the guy's name, and he did something awful. And the next day he said in the press, and I'm not saying Matt Harvey should do this, yeah, I'm going to beam the son of a bitch. I'm going to hit him, and I'm going to hit him, and I'm going to hit him again and again because what he did was wrong. But Tommy John never threw a pitch near his head, near his body, but he got him thinking about it. He got him thinking, it's kind of like the line in Field of Dreams, right? It's 2-0. Where do you think the next one's going to be, kid? Down and away or in my ear? And then Joe Jackson says, watch out for down and away, but be careful for in your ear. And it may look, I don't think Matt Harvey's going to hit him. I think if there is going to be some retribution, it'll either be A, on the base paths, which might incite a bench-clearing brawl, or B, it'll happen in like a 5-1 game, and Hansel Robles will throw it at him. Or Eric Goodell. It will not be Matt Harvey.
Now, the other thing, of course, that comes about out of this, the Mets, who beat Clayton Kershaw in game one, were winning going into this play, and then this kind of changed momentum, and the Dodgers went on to win 5-2. And if anyone wants to call in and talk about this stuff, 760-283-0846. Now, you did think the Dodgers were going to win the game anyway and had the momentum. Where do you see – we have game three tonight, Harvey versus – was it Brett Anderson or Alex Wood? I'm not sure.
It's Brett Anderson.
Okay. So what are we looking at here? Is this a must-win game for the Mets?
Absolutely. Must-win game for the Mets. No question about it. You got your supposed ace on the mound who's coming off, what, like 8 days rest. AJ's not, he pitched last Saturday, so yeah, like 8 days rest. He's not coming out tonight. Like if he's on a roll, I believe he's pitching the whole game. The stadium is going to be pumping. By the way, the Cardinals just tied it up at one. Kyle Schwarber hit a home run, and I think it was Jason Hayward just hit a double to tie it up for the Cardinals in a 1-1 series game. But, yeah, this is a must-win. I mean, you know my beliefs. I don't think that the Mets, granted, they got to Greinke in the last game. I think they have a harder time with Greinke than they did with Kershaw. Although game one was absolutely masterful for both pitchers. I don't think they win game five in L.A., so I think they have to win the next two games. Cardinals are up 2-1. So, yeah, I think it's a must-win game, and I think tomorrow is another must-win game. I don't think they win game five in L.A.
Do you think they can beat Kershaw twice?
Yes, absolutely. I think they could be I think they could be anybody at home. This team has won so many games at home. I think they could beat anybody at home. I think Kershaw. You know what? Kershaw. He didn't get the win. He got the loss the other night, but that was him and DeGrom. That was as dominant a pitching performance from two pitchers in the same game that I've ever seen. Kershaw had one bad pitch. That's it. But I still think they can beat him at home. So, yeah, I think they can beat him twice in the series and take it. But it all depends on tonight. They lose tonight. I think they win tomorrow anyway. I think Steve Matz – look, the Dodgers haven't seen a lefty from the Mets yet. And the only hitter that I'm really afraid of, and you and I have discussed this offline, the only – hitter I'm really afraid of in that order is Adrian Gonzalez, and he's a lefty.
Moving on to some of the other baseball. Texas wins the first two games in Toronto. Toronto comes back, wins game three, is up 8-4 in the ninth. We're looking at a game five back at, I was about to say the Sky Dome, but I guess it is. Is it still the Sky Dome that they play at? It must be.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear your question, Seth. I missed it.
I said, it's still the Sky Dome in Toronto, right?
It is still, it's the Rogers Center.
Rogers Center, yeah. It's been interesting all over. You have Kansas City about ties the series with Houston. We're going back there for game five. And St. Louis trying to put away a pesky Cubs team up 2-1 in the fourth. Actually, I'm sorry, that's game three. Game three or game four?
Game four.
No, that is game four. Yeah, they're up 2-1. So what is besides the obvious Dodger-Mets, what has made the biggest impression so far for you through the first week of the playoffs?
Jake Arrieta is still phenomenal. The pitching in this, at least in the National League, has been tremendous. The American League, well, we know it was going to be hitting all the way, and it has been. Toronto doing their justice, and the Royals just never quit. I mean, the Royals came back today from, I believe it was 4 down, and took the game 9-5. It's been very, very exciting. Truth be told, I've been really focused on the Mets, but you know what? It's really strange to me. It's still strange to me that Houston's in the American League. I was talking about that the other day with a friend of mine. And having a championship series of Houston and Texas is a little, I don't know, it would be something I'd look forward to, both being the underdogs. But I still think Toronto's going to pull this one out.
Well, going home for game five, I can certainly see where you're coming from. Let's jump a little bit let's jump to college football. There's a bunch of stories that are going on. Obviously, I have been a big proponent of Randy Edsall being fired since approximately the day that Randy Edsall was hired. it never struck me as a good fit. It never struck me as a, he never struck me as a guy who was going to bring Maryland and, you know, now the quote unquote potential Oregon of the East with all the money from Under Armour and Kevin Plank. He never struck me as the guy that was going to bring him to the next year. I also didn't, I did not, to be fair, think that he was going to be, he was going to actually bring them down. The team has digressed. Actually, a pretty good effort losing to Ohio State, who is nowhere near the number one team in the country right now. I don't care what the rankings say. They haven't looked good at all this year. You know, being tied in the third, but this was inevitable, and we had talked about it a little bit last week. Officially fired yesterday. The offensive coordinator is there, Mike Locksley, who was 2-26 as a head coach. I don't see this coming. As an outsider, what kind of job do you see Maryland at? A mid-tier, a low-tier, something with some potential to become an upper-tier? Or is it, where do you go? And I'm not saying to pick a, I'm not saying pick specific coaches. I don't mean it along those lines. Where do you see this going for them?
Look, there are they're going to throw a ton of money at somebody. But quite frankly, Seth, you and I both went to basketball schools that are trying at some point to be football schools, and they're just not. And they're in two very, very hard conferences to make that leap. I'm putting Maryland with the Purdues or with the Indianas or with, Northwestern is a great coach and has done very well this year, but Northwestern is not generally a top 25 team either. I don't see Maryland making that leap into the top five or six of the Big Ten. They're just never going to compete. They may compete once in a while, kind of like Syracuse competed when they had Donovan McNabb. You got that one guy that could really bring you to that promised land. But you're lucking out in that. McNabb was a top, I think, 100 recruit or 300 recruit. He wasn't even recruited to be a quarterback originally. He was recruited to be a safety. So you luck out. But I know your move to the Big Ten, at least the Maryland move to the Big Ten, was for financial reasons. But you went from being a bigger fish in a smaller pond to being a very, very small fish in one of the biggest ponds. It very much reminds me of what Boston College did when they first moved to the ACC, because they were a big fish in the Big East pond in football and in basketball, and they went to the biggest pond in basketball and one of the bigger ponds in football, and they became a very, very small fish.
Well, I agree and disagree with you, because, I mean, as you said, you talked about Syracuse jumping over to the ACC and talking about how it's a big jump, and maybe from where they were, because they were kind of in a nothing football conference, it is, but it's not a great football conference. The Big Ten the last few years has gotten significantly better. I've stated 1,000 times on this show that I thought it was overrated as a football conference and underrated as a basketball conference for about a 5 or 6 year span. The one thing, there are a couple things I do see as a potential where there is some hope for Maryland. Number one, as I said, the enormous amount of money and / influence that Kevin Plank has with Under Armour. We saw what it did to Oregon when they had the right coach, Chip Kelly. Now they lost at home to Washington State. So now that Kelly's recruits are gone, you're seeing that Mark Herzlick is really not, you know, it was the beneficiary of Chip Kelly's players. Number two, they have a monster recruiting class coming in, and what they're doing, and this is smart, what Locksley, who also ran a lot of their recruiting, did, was he pretty much tried to recruit the DMV, meaning the Baltimore to D.C., Virginia area, D.C., Maryland, Virginia, and has done extremely well. They have the number two or number three quarterback in the country, and this is where I almost see this going, and I'm just going to laugh And his top three choices were Maryland, Rutgers, and Alabama. And he ended up, he's a Maryland guy, and he ended up going to Maryland. But the guy who recruited him hardest is the offensive coordinator of Alabama, Lane Kiffin. And I would not be surprised if they see if that's who they go after. It would be a controversial hire, but if you want to make a run, I don't think, you know, people are saying Chip Kelly. I don't see Chip Kelly leaving the Eagles. Kevin Anderson needs to make some kind of offensive splash with this hire. And whether it's a big-time assistant who just became a coach like Tom Herman at Houston or Chad Morris at LSU or at SMU, there were the assistant coaches, there were the offensive coordinators at Clemson and Ohio State, respectively. I just see him trying to be I see it coming. And I'm laughing because obviously the one school we also have to talk about today, and we'll get on that right now, is USC, where Kiffin was fired coming out of LAX airport 2 years ago in the middle of bad season. And, you know, when you don't think you can one-up that, well, Steve Sarkisian apparently came to the meeting drunk yesterday. Maybe that's what happens when you lose when you lose that kind of game to Washington, where you coached previous. And Pat Hayden, the AD, initially suspended him and now fired him today. And talk about a job that everybody is going to be going after. USC, a creme de la creme job in the last time. Now, unfortunately, it is a school kind of in chaos. And 2 years you've had mid-season firings, which just never happens.
Yeah, I mean, look, there are lots of NFL coaches that may be looking into that job. Chip Kelly may be one of them because USC definitely went after him before. Jack Del Rio is a USC guy. Jeff Fisher is a USC guy. Does he lose his job if the Rams don't continue down a good path, both of which I think will be looked hard at? It's a big job. It's a good job. It's one of those top-tier jobs. That's the job that Maryland wants to be, but they won't be. But is there a chance in that job? Look, they have great recruiting classes, but USC has not been a successful program in a very long period of time, being 10, 12 years.
No, what are you talking? No, absolutely not.
Reggie Bush was what? Reggie Bush?
Oh, nine?
Oh, it's like 7 years ago. Excuse me, I'm sorry, 7 years.
Yeah, they have not been the same since Vince Young ran for that touchdown on fourth and 10 in probably one of the three greatest college football games I've ever seen. I want to say the 08 or 09 Rose Bowl. They've been consistently solid, but nothing spectacular. And they've gone through a pantheon of coaches. That's when, obviously, Pete Carroll left. It has had incredible amount of success up in Seattle. It's going to be it's the dream job for a lot of coaches, whether you're a head coach. Now, I'm curious to see where Steve Sarkisian was Pat Hayden's call. He's the AD. And you can have one mess up, and Pat Hayden, a USC guy, a Rhodes Scholar, you know, doing this job for free, actually. You can have one mess up. You can't have two. So,
well,
I am
remember, Pat Hayden is a legend at USC. So,
yeah,
it's a little different when, A, you're doing it for free, as you said, and, B, you're a legend. I mean, Pat Hayden is a Rhodes Scholar. He won a Heisman Trophy at that school.
No,
he bleeds that school. I mean, it would kind of be like, I don't know, you look at other guys that are in similar situations. Tom Osborne in Nebraska when he was the AD, and he messed up Frank Solich, right? I mean,
I
you can mess up.
I like the reference, but I don't consider it. First of all, Pat Hayden did not win the Heisman. No. Also, I don't consider Solich a failure. I consider Solich, you're following a guy who had 400 wins and three national titles. Solich averaged about 9 to 10 wins a season. It was just, you know, you can't follow a certain legend. Sarkisian did not follow a legend. Sarkisian followed, you know, Ed Orgeron, who followed Lane Kiffin. And, you know, Sarkisian was a logical choice. He was a West Coast guy. He went to play at BYU. He was OC at USC before getting the head job at Washington. But, I mean, I'm not quite sure what it's, you know, we all know that these coaches are under an enormous amount of pressure, this, that. The other thing, he's going through a divorce. And look, we had a discussion about alcoholism with, in regards to CC Sabathia last week. But I've never heard of a coach showing up drunk to meetings before. Again, I'm not, I don't have that much insight.
Look, Seth, there's no excuse for that. But is that Pat Hayden's fault?
No, but at the end of the day, you're hiring based on a character.
Right, but your character wait a second. Look, I agree with you on the fact that Sarkisian showed up drunk. Sarkisian should not have this job. I'm with you, okay? I think it is far-reaching to say that a guy who starts 3 or 4 years ago, who may not have been an alcoholic, you hired him at that point, now he becomes one, and you have to foresee that.
No. No one's going to foresee that. I understand that. But he's only been there for 2 years, number one. But he was an offensive coordinator there. Now, again, I don't know what Hayden knew and what Hayden didn't know. I'm assuming if he knew, he was under the impression that he was a this personality type, he probably would not have been hired.
That's where I'm going with this. So I get what you're saying. I get that you're saying that Pat Hayden's got one more shot. Look, he's got to make a dent in this. I don't think he has to have a perfect record, but he certainly has to hire a high moral guy, if nothing else. And I know we made light of this when Nebraska got Mike Riley, right? I mean, we said, what the heck is Nebraska doing getting a Mike Riley? But is that really, looking back on these types of hires, where there are certainly coaches in towns that embarrass their teams. Looking back on Mike Riley, you don't hear a peep out of that. So
yeah.
I'm not saying that Riley was the best case scenario, but Riley, sometimes you're the right fit for a school, even if you're not a great coach.
Yeah, the problem being, as you said, this is Nebraska, where they think themselves as God's gift to football. And if you're asking, would they rather have a corrupt guy, you know, not that Bo Pelini, who is, you know, never won a relevant game and never lost an irrelevant game, and 8-4 and have the beer, the screaming and the shouting and all this, or you have Nebraska 2-4, just been an absolute and utter abomination. Well, you know, I don't know what to tell you. I know what I would do, but I don't live and breathe it the way that Nebraska does. So I have a feeling Mike Riley, class act, may not be there for long. Going on, something you don't hear very often, Florida, who's been irrelevant for the last 3 or 4 years, making an absolute phenomenal comeback this year under first-year coach Jim McElvain, and their quarterback is suspended for the year. Not for what you would expect. When you hear, you know, players are suspended, you know, unfortunately in this era, you kind of assume it's something truly to the negative. This one's just strange, that he was kicked out for PEDs. And I guess it's not something that can be appealed. I think it was done internally.
Well, what has been reported, and there's no disputing this, I've seen no reports that dispute this, is that he took an over-the-counter supplement that had something that was not on the list, or was on the list, or had a banned supplement. But the fact is, with the NFL, as with most sports, you're responsible for your body and what you put in it. And it's not a matter of an appeal, Seth. It happened. He admitted that he took this supplement, so now it's a matter of you got to pay the price. The issue with this is that he is suspended for a full year, which means not only can he not play the rest of this year, but he can't play the first 7 games of next year either, and he can't practice. So really, I have a hard time with this suspension to the extent that it is. I don't think he should be allowed to play, but I think the rest of this season should be sufficient enough for that.
Yeah, I agree. It seems way over the top. And, you know, it just seems way over the top. There's no real other way to put it. You know, an interesting week in college football this week. I mean, not going to go too deep into it. There was no major upset. But, you know, Baylor could have won by 7. It was up 60-0 at the half. Happy for Charlie Strong winning the Texas-Oklahoma game because he's been getting a lot of grief. And, you know, the big game next week is you have Michigan State, where Michigan was, you know, the first week, they thought that you'd see a moderate improvement. You did not think they would be the best team in the Big Ten. And that's what they're looking like. Michigan State has not looked good, barely beating Rutgers. And you have LSU-Florida, which, you know, we have no idea what to make out of Florida at this point.
Well, let me jump in real quick. We talked earlier, and we've talked a lot about the influence of a coach and what a coach can do for a team and what the lack of a coach does for a team also. Man, they're looking really good in Ann Arbor right now, aren't they? They shelled out a lot of money.
Back-to-back shutouts. I don't remember the last time I even heard about that.
They shelled out a lot of money, but they got the right guy, didn't they? At least for them. And this, again, this comes down to the same thing. He was the right guy for them. He might have not been the right guy for, say, a Nebraska or Ohio State. But he was the right guy for them. And, man, Big Blue, well, at least in college, Big Blue, because we'll talk about Big Blue in the NFL in a little bit. Big Blue stands right behind Jim Harbaugh all the way right now. I mean, results are there. He has turned that program around in less than a year.
Yeah. And well, as the games get better and better, we'll talk more and more college football. But I guess it is time to transition to the big boy sport. Our first firing, it was not surprising. It was well-deserved. Joe Philbin is out. Dan Campbell is in as your interim coach down in Miami. Their offense has been terrible. Their defense has been pretty bad. We're starting to hear, you know, you hear crazy rumors. You hear they're going to trade for Sean Payton, who's going to bring Drew Brees with them. I mean, the one good thing we talked about is actually, that's true. That was the rumor. Is that the rumor you started?
That's a rumor I started last night. So,
Sean Payton, the Drew Brees part. I guess it comes back to a lot of things that, hey, they're trying to make up for the mistake they made 9 years ago when Nick Saban decided his arm was not healthy enough to ever be a solid quarterback in the NFL.
Yeah, let's go get Dante Culpepper, whose knee was shredded instead.
Exactly. So, you know, we're looking, you know, you're looking at a team. I don't even know where there's talent there. And maybe Dan Campbell's the guy to get it, although I'm sure he's not, you know, he's not the long-term solution. But Philbin always just kind of, he never seemed like he was a good fit for that team. He always kind of seemed a little bit too detached to me. And, you know, this is a team that needed motivation, and he's not a motivating kind of guy. He's not a motivator.
Well, I mean, this comes down to the right fit for, I mean, I don't mean to keep harping on it, but it's very true. You need to be the right fit for your team and your team chemistry. And when you have guys like Ryan Tannehill and you had Mike Wallace and you had guys that don't exactly exude the great work ethic, especially last week's report that Tannehill went after practice players and said, hey, you're just on the practice team. What the heck are you doing? It kind of straight out of Rudy, right? Why are you practicing so hard? You'll never make the team anyway. You kind of look at, I think his name was Jamie O'Keefe in the movie Rudy, Vince Vaughn. You kind of look at it and go, maybe that the surrounding atmosphere is not the greatest. And Dan Campbell, was I was shocked. I remembered who this guy was, the old tight end for the Giants. Has a lot of Bill Parcells in him, from what I understand. Has a lot of Bill Belichick, Maurice Carthon, Marcus Pope, all these guys. He brings that oomph, or he brings that special quality, hopefully, for that team. And as a Jets fan, I'm hoping that happens because they play the Patriots twice. So if you can beat them once, that would be very helpful. Who do you think, if anybody, is going to be the next fire? Because I don't think Coughlin's getting fired now, especially after last night's game. So is there going to be another firing in the NFL this year, during the season?
During the season, I don't think so. I think you kind of have to look a little bit in Detroit. That team is absolutely self-destructing. And, I mean, nobody really thought Jim Caldwell was a great coach in Indy. You know, he took over for Tony Dungy and, kind of similar, kind of rode the coattails of Peyton Manning. You know, it's you see him in a secondary situation, and, you know, this team has talent, but they are a complete and utter cluster beep. And, you know, losing at home by 30 points, Matthew Stafford looks like a shell of the player he used to be. And he wasn't a great player then. So,
Seth, the important thing about firings and coaches is that they generally occur right before the bye, right, or during the bye week. So you give your coach enough time for the next. And it's very important to note when looking for guys that are going to get fired or jobs where you think there may be a firing, where the team's bye week is. So we just finished, week 5 of the NFL? Because the Jets are 3-1 and had their bye. So we just finished week 5. Detroit does not have a bye week until week 9. So if they go 0-8, right now they're 0-5, and I'm looking up who they play in the next 3 weeks. So their next 3 weeks are Chicago at home, which is a winnable game, no question. Minnesota at home, also a winnable game. And then at Kansas City with no Jamal Charles, if they lose it's not at Kansas City, it's actually in London. I can see them making your case of Jim Caldwell on the flight back from London if they lose all 3 of those games.
Yeah, to be fair, those are 2 pretty winnable games. And Caldwell is in the second year of a contract. And it, as you said, it's very rare when you see coaches get fired during the season. And I don't have any great answer on who would be his replacement. I know the names are going to be thrown out. Adam Gase in Chicago, I'm sure, will be.
Go look at their assistant coaches because those are the guys
They fired their assistant coaches.
Detroit?
Both of their assistants are. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were talking about Miami. My fault.
No. I was looking at Detroit. And actually,
well, Austin.
Miami only fired their defensive assistant. I don't think they fired their offensive coach.
I think Glazer's out also.
Oh, Glazer's out as well. So, I mean.
Yeah, I think he got fired a couple days later.
If they lose, if the Lions go to 0-8, I think you have to look at Detroit being a team that may lose their coach. The thing is about Detroit and the Ford family is that they are very patient with their coaches. I mean, they waited for Rod Marinelli to go a full 0-16 before they fired him. So an in-season firing for somebody from the Lions, not really seeing it. I just don't. And the other teams that have late bye weeks, Chicago is next, is in week 7. They're not getting – John Fox is not getting fired. Chip Kelly's not getting fired in week 8. Jay Gruden probably not getting fired in week 8. Bill O'Brien, not in week 9. The Niners had the week 10 bye, but I can't see them firing the guy that they just handpicked to to replace Harbaugh. And then Mike Pettine is week 11 for the Browns. But I'll tell you, if Josh McCown keeps throwing 500 yards, he's not going anywhere either. Wow, Josh McCown, almost 500 yards and the most yards in Browns history in one game.
It may not sound impressive to those of you in your 20s, but you have to, because, I mean, you look at the quarterbacks they've had over the last 5-10 years. You know, Derek Anderson has been the best of the group. It's not really saying a heck of a lot. But remember, if you look back in the 80s, in the 90s, or in the 80s, excuse me, you had Brian Sipe, you had Bernie Kosar, you have Otto Graham, one of the five probably best quarterbacks of all time. A phenomenal performance by McCown. And, winning over words I never really thought I would say, a hapless Ravens team, a team with no defense. And, you know, Joe Flacco trying to single-handedly carry that team. Justin Forsett gets hurt. They have no wideouts. The only team with a worse wideout situation from a health perspective, I think, than the Giants. They look like they're going nowhere. And four games behind Cincy, who comes back from 24-7 down to beat Seattle. And that is a very, very good team, that Bengals team. That defense looks inspired again. You know, Atkins looks like he did. Looks like he's back to where he was pre-ACL injury. Dalton looks like he's deserving this contract. And as I said actually in our preview, it's hard to read this team because they have so many guys going into a contract year. But this is a very, very motivated and very angry-seeming Bengals team right now.
Hold on a second. Just to give you all an update, Chris Bryant just did a 2-run home run in Wrigley Field over the left field stands. They're up 4-2 in what is a series that is 1-1. I'm sorry, it was into the left field bleachers. It was not over them. But it was a shot. It was off the bat gone in Wrigley.
You know St. Louis is going to – you know St. Louis is not going down in Chicago. So this is a must win for the Cubs. I think that came out wrong. I do not think the Cubs win in St. Louis in a game 5. So I thought that series was 2-1. The series is 1-1?
Series.
Yeah, I guess.
I made so much baseball going on that I think it's 1-1 because they follow the Mets schedule. The Mets are 1-1
okay,
as of today.
And Arrieta's pitching, so it probably is 1-1.
In 3 of 5, yep. So anyway, yeah, back to your Giants last night. So you and I both had the same opinion while we watched the game that Eli was going to throw one or two of those bad balls. We saw one that was intercepted towards the end of the first half, and then we saw a second one that probably should have been intercepted but wasn't. And then Eli throws his second David Tyree ball to Larry Donnell to win the game. So I ask you two things. First of all, are you upset that you left the bar?
No.
Okay.
No, I had to work. I worked while I watched.
Because the bar was going nuts, I'll tell you that much. And
I'm sure.
And that 149er fan couldn't get out of there fast enough. And,
I'm sure.
Yeah, and secondly, how does it feel to be in first place of the hapless division known as the NFC East?
Well, I guess I look at it like this. Would you rather be first place in a hapless division in the NFC East, or would you rather be probably a team, or would you rather be 3-1 and in second place with really no hope of overtaking the first place team?
Well, I agree.
Very well.
Look, I'm with you.
I'll take it. I mean, I still have no real feel for how this team is. They very well could have been 5-0. They very well could have been 2-3 or 1-4. Credit, you know, I've never been the biggest Eli fan, but credit where credit is deserved. When you go 87 yards with your top three wideouts not playing, there is something to be said for that. Yes, you had a pass interference. Yes, you had Shane Vereen. The Donald catch was phenomenal. It's funny. It's the second time I've heard the Tyree. I don't really see it as a Tyree catch, but I just thought it was an absolutely brilliant play by Larry Donald.
Now, the reason why people say it's Tyree, and the reason I did, is he pinned it against the helmet.
Yeah, but I didn't see it quite as
smooth. It wasn't the same. Nobody, look, I'm not viewing it as the same type of catch. I'm saying he pinned it against his helmet. You don't see that very often. Period.
No, you don't.
So
no, you don't.
The only reason that ball did not pop out is because he pinned it against his helmet. Because he didn't have full control. He just pushed it against his helmet, which, very smart move. But for a guy that has had awful hands, who reminds me of Stonehands, the necessary roughness, that was a play he had to make. Eli put the ball exactly where he needed to put it. And you and I have had this discussion many times about Eli. Those are the balls he needs to – those are the types of throws he needs to make. He needs to put more throws where only his guys can get it, even if they're incomplete. The throw at the end of the first half was nauseating, absolutely nauseating, because we've seen it over and over and over again. So and Shane Vereen looks like one of the best free agent pickups in the NFL.
Yeah, which shocks me. I really did not know how he would fit into this offense. But they are 3-2, and they look – they can stay healthy or get healthy. You know,
well, I'll tell you, you want to know how he fits in this offense? I think if Beckham and Randall are out next week, you're going to see Shane Vereen split out a lot.
I don't think you have a choice.
Right,
we don't know when Cruz is coming back. You know, he's supposed to be back for week 4. Randall was hurt. Beckham was injured, but I mean, although he did play in the last couple of plays, he was pretty much a decoy. Otherwise, you may be looking at Akeem Nix, or maybe or Amani Toomer, or maybe we can bring Frank Gifford back because they have nothing. Get bail Mark Ingram out of jail. Stephen Baker, the touchdown maker. We don't have too much left. But we'll see what happens. You know, Jets enjoying a bye. You know, probably not the week they wanted to do it, coming off a nice, easy win, the week before in Miami. Anything else you really want to touch on?
Well,
for week 4?
If you thought that the Jets had a good defense before, this week they get back Sheldon Richardson, who may be their best defensive player. They go and play Washington, and then they play Washington at home, which, you know what, you could see as a trap game coming off a bye week, and next week they have New England away. And we always like New England away, not particularly, but we'll see what happens. Take away from week 4 in the week 5 in the NFL, the Bengals, you're right, are absolutely for real. Seattle needs to find a way to throw the ball to Jimmy Graham because he's useless. I watched that entire game, and he is absolutely useless. And part of the reasoning that they can't throw it to him is Russell Wilson has been sacked 22 times. He's on a pace of 70 sacks. That's David Carr numbers. He can't handle it. He's only 5'11".
Who figured in the Max Unger Jimmy Graham deal that Max Unger, the center for Seattle, would end up probably seems like it's been more advantageous than New Orleans. Although, not that New Orleans has looked particularly sensational this year, getting annihilated by a relatively mediocre Philly team, you know, kind of running through, not really too nothing major to discuss. I mean, you may be looking at a QB change in Dallas, New England annihilating them. We talked about Arizona, Buffalo in a terrible game. You know, when Green Bay kind of cruises through St. Louis, Chicago kind of on a fluky play by Jay Cutler. Beats Kansas City. Jamaal Charles, unfortunately, out for the year with a torn ACL. Atlanta, down most of the game, comes back and wins in an interception return for a touchdown by Robert Alford over Washington. Tampa beats Jacksonville in probably the most entertaining game of the week. But, you know, in a pretty good Monday night game tonight, Pittsburgh at San Diego. You know, Roethlisberger's still out, but you still have, of course, you have Michael Vick, who's going to his umpteenth comeback, playing with Antonio Brown, and Martavis Bryant comes back from suspension. You have, of course, Le'Veon Bell, and then you have San Diego, who always seems to, you know, nobody really knows what make out of this team. Now, what are your thoughts on tonight's game?
Well, Antonio Gates is back tonight, and Martavis Bryant may not play because he's not only he's back from suspension, but he's also injured. So it'll be interesting to see if he plays. I think San Diego wins this game and wins it by at least a touchdown. I'm going 27-17. I think San Diego wins this game. I think Melvin Gordon comes out and has a great game. And wins me a fantasy league this week. I need.
I was wondering if there was a secondary rationale for that.
I think it anyway, but I think 27.
I like. I actually like Pittsburgh. I like it around 31-26, 31-27.
Wow.
I don't think either defense shuts down. Yeah. Well, these are two offenses. You know, this is not the steel curtain that we're playing, that we're looking at here.
So, for our final thought, let me ask you this. How much are we spending on Jamaal Charles replacement tomorrow? We have a budget of $180. I know we have to spend some money. It's not tomorrow, it's Wednesday. What are your thoughts? Let's hear them. We need a running back, or we need at least the semblance of a running back. And this is the guy that's going to be, I think, the guy we spend the money on. How much do you want to spend?
60-70 seems about right. The numbers are pointless. That's what Peterson went for. And, yes, we cruise. It looks like we're going to cruise to a fifth straight victory. We need 1 point out of, well.
No, we need 10 points.
So we need 10 points out of Le'Veon Bell and Antonio Brown. So we need one touchdown pretty much between the two.
And Lawrence Simmons.
Okay, so I think we're doing okay. Want to touch quickly. You brought this up last night, but because of everything that happened, we haven't had a chance to talk too much about it. U.S. soccer, whether it's time for Jurgen Klinsmann to be fired, and there's kind of a clamoring for that after they lose the CONCACAF, the Confederates Cup final, to Mexico 3-2 in overtime. They've stagnated. There's no other way to put it. I'm not sure. You know, there was an article in ESPN, I forget who wrote it, I mean, it was Sports Illustrated by Grant Wall, saying that, you know, when they brought in Klinsmann, they brought him in as both a technical director and as a coach. And while he may be the right guy as a technical director, there's a lot of question whether he's the right guy to be the coach. They're not playing their youth. They're playing their veterans, and they need to see what they have in some of the – and develop some more. The game was actually extremely entertaining. Even if you're not a soccer fan, it was one of those games that was very easy, especially the second half, to watch, very up and down. We'll see what happens. It is a team in disarray, but better to be in disarray in 2015 than 2017, a year before the World Cup in Russia.
We got 40 seconds. What is prediction on the Mets game tonight? Very quickly, 30 seconds. Go.
Pain. Lots of pain.
Give me a score, quick.
4-2 Mets.
Okay, I think the Mets win 3-1, so same two-run differential. I think Harvey goes into the seventh inning. Okay, that's it for this. For Seth Kamens, this has been Sean Palmer, backsportspage.com, Seth and Sean Sports Radio. See you all next week. And, at least I'll see you next week. Seth, you're on next week, right?
I'm off. No, I'm off next week. Have a good one, everybody.
Just me and somebody else. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.